Spirit Blade Underground, episode 492. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, a review of the Winchester, a review of, not, it's not the Winchester, it's just called Winchester, the house that ghosts built, and some thoughts on Monster Hunter World as well, and finally a look at what husbands and wives are called to in marriage as we continue in the book of Ephesians. Here we go.
Nice, another achievement unlocked. I bet I got more achievements than anybody I know.
Yes, sitting in front of a video game for 5 hours a day is quite an achievement.
See, this is why I don't like talking to you.
Then why don't you spend more time with real people?
Because real people don't respond to console commands.
Wow, Peter. You unlocked yet another achievement. You must have more achievements than anyone you know. Behold, you are great, and greatly to be praised.
Yeah, better.
This week, I spent about 6 hours playing Monster Hunter World on the PS4. It's also available on Xbox One and is coming to PC, I think, in the fall, I want to say. Anyway, this game has been on my radar for a little while. I have not played any of the Monster Hunter World games before, but this one, based on what I saw at E3 last year, I was like, this could totally be my thing, because it looks like they're going for a more open-worldish type style, and they're also giving it a big single-player emphasis. Historically, the Monster Hunter games have had a big multiplayer focus. This one still does, but they were really putting effort this time around to making it absolutely doable as a single-player experience, and that was really the only reason I even bothered giving it a try. And the other elements, you know, the basic concept of the game and the game series, as I understand it, is that you basically have like a hub town that you're in, and you're just going out into these big open areas and hunting down different monsters of different ranks and difficulties and stuff. And as you kill a monster, you can get stuff from their body, you know, their bones and their skin or whatever, you know, their organs are, and use those bits that you get from them to craft better armor and better weapons so that you can go and take on bigger and tougher monsters. And these are, you know, it's not like a dungeon crawl in that, you know, you're kind of hacking and slashing at a bunch of monsters all the time. There are some of that. There are some smaller monsters you're going to run into, but when you go out on a hunt, you're usually pretty quickly into the game, you're usually going out and taking on large, like a single large monster. And it takes a while to take them down. It can take, like, you know, just the first few hunts that I've been on, it takes about 7 to 10 minutes, because you got to whack on the monster for a while, and then he's going to, you know, not only defend himself and leap around in the area, eventually he'll start running and leaving the area. You have to follow him and track him down and stuff, and you have to track him, you have to find his location to begin with by going out into these open areas and finding little like tracks that are kind of glowing, you know, so you can go over and click on them, or, you know, hit your button, and that will kind of make it easier for you to find the next glowing track, and so on and so forth. And anyway, in Monster Hunter World, you have these little glowing flies that that follow you around. If you've played the Fable games, it's very similar to what that glowing trail that you can optionally have in front of you. I think you might be able to, I think I heard somewhere that you could turn off the flies if you want in Monster Hunter World, but I wouldn't do that, personally. But the thing, I need every advantage I can get in this game. The thing with this series is that it's known for being very difficult to get into. It's very like a, I guess, inside baseball. You either, you know it, or you are an outsider, you know. And if you didn't get in on the ground floor back of the first game on, what, the PS2 or something like that, then you're, you know, historically you're going to be lost every time a new game in the series comes out, because it expects you to be well familiar with the established systems in the series. And that's the other reason that, like, I was, you know, initially like, this probably isn't for me, but then was drawn to it when I heard that they were really making an effort with this one to make it approachable for new players. And, you know, I've watched a bunch of reviews. I usually don't do that. I usually don't watch reviews of things that I'm about to review because I want to kind of go in fresh. But this time I really did take in as much content as I could, both in terms of reviews and like tips and tricks and stuff, because I was like, chances are I'm going to need everything that I can, you know, glean from these other videos and resources in order to kind of get my foot in the water and feel like I can take on this game. But the reason I felt like it was worth going to all that trouble is I've just heard of the richness in these games, that if you do give the time to understanding how each of the weapons works, because each of the weapons has its own entirely different control scheme, and if you, you know, if you learn all the systems that are available to you in the game, then you can really get a lot out of it. I mean, there are people that apparently, even though the campaign is, you know, only maybe 40 hours, something like that, 40 or 50 hours, there are people that put 200, 300 hours into each one of these games, you know, so there's that looting and upgrading progression that I think is really driving a lot of the play. And that's something that I really enjoy in dungeon crawls. And on top of that, I really, as you might know, I really enjoy monster movies, because I love kind of like running into, you know, or not running into, but when you're watching a monster movie, and first there are just little hints of the monster. They're hiding it very carefully, and you don't really understand the nature of the monster. Just fleeting glimpses, people disappearing, and little bits of residue or something left behind. And then as the movie continues, you start to understand more of the monster. You start to see more of the monster until the end. There's this kind of like revelation of what the monster is and all of its horrible glory, you know. And so I like monsters, and I like different weird looking monsters, and learning what their shtick is, what their powers or whatever are, what they can do. And so that was another reason that I was like, man, yeah, if this game is based on the idea of going out, figuring out, you know, tracking down monsters, getting intel on them to find out what they're weak to and stuff like that, and there's a whole prep process, you know, to these hunts, I'm like, that sounds kind of cool, you know. And it's in a fantasy setting, arguably kind of like a steampunk slash pirate setting a little bit. I'm not into pirates, but the pirate theme is not really heavy in this game. It's mostly just kind of like steampunk fantasy, I would say. Anyway, so I've spent 6 hours with the game so far, and I've had mixed feelings about it, but I mean, I have really been enjoying a lot of it. There have been a number of tutorials that have been thrown at me as I'm getting into the game, and you know, they're not like heavily animated things, you know, that they, you know, they're just like these, you know, text windows that come up and you got to read a little bit, you know. So that's basically the most effort they put into tutorials. Although I will say that at the very beginning of the game, they really like block off a bunch of controls. They very slowly introduce you just to the controls. And, like, you can't even pull up the options menu or anything. It's just, like, you know, left stick to move forward. I mean, like, really, really slowly bringing you in. And so I really appreciated that. But once they did give me access to the options menu about maybe 5 minutes in, then suddenly I found that I could dig through these different user interface menus. And I was like, there's a whole maze of stuff here. There's layers upon layers. What the crap am I supposed to... am I supposed to understand? How much of this am I supposed to know? You know, and that feeling really persisted as I continued through the first, you know, 6 hours of the game. I was just kind of always wondering, am I supposed to know more than I do right now? And I just had to kind of resolve to like, well, okay, I don't get all these systems. I don't want to take the time to try and dig through the menus and learn them all. I'm going to just hope and assume that the game is going to teach me what I need to know when I need to know it. And I'm not going to hold myself responsible to dig through all these menus and understand all these terms and stuff right now. I'm just going to go and based on the knowledge that, you know, is easily and openly given to me, and then play as far as I can until I hit a wall. And that's really served me well. I mean, there's still a ton of things that I'm like, oh man, there's so many systems here I don't understand. And yet I'm not failing at the missions. You know, I'm actually doing fairly well, I think. I mean, especially for me, someone that is not good at thinking fast, is not good at action games, really doesn't have good hand-eye coordination. These kinds of like high pressure, you know, quick thinking games, I am normally not into at all. And on top of all that, they put a time limit on the missions. Every monster hunt is 50 minutes or less. Some of them, I think, are as short as 30 or 20 minutes. I could be wrong about that, but most of them are 50 minutes, I'm told. But that initially was a huge turnoff. I'm like, I hate failing in a mission because an arbitrary time limit elapses. I have always hated that. But as I was reading before I bought the game, there was a number of veterans of Monster Hunter that were saying, no, don't worry about that. It's just so that most of these hunts, you should be able to finish in like 10 or 20 minutes, you know, really quickly. The 50 minute thing there is just so that, you know, you're not wasting your time beating against a steel wall with a feather, you know. If you don't have the right gear, you know, then eventually 50 minutes will lapse and it'll just be like, sorry, partner, we're cutting you off. You're not ready for this, you know. And so really the time limit should rarely be a factor at all. And that has so far been my experience, so that's been really cool. I also learned that, as a solo player, you're still largely going to be playing online. There does seem to be an offline mode, which I ran into kind of by accident when I shut my system down or put it in rest mode for a while. When I came back to it, I had an error message saying I'd been disconnected from the internet, which sometimes happens when I put my PS4 in rest mode, and it just said that that it's going to continue in offline mode and you just won't be able to take advantage of any of the blah, 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 you know. And I was like, okay, cool. So there's an offline mode. What's kind of annoying is that when I first booted up the game, I kind of got scared because the first thing I saw before any menus was a notification that you are not able to use this feature because you do not have PlayStation Plus. I don't have that monthly, you know, subscription service to play online games for PlayStation 4. I've never had a reason to. And I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh. They said in the description that I only needed that for multiplayer. What is this? So I don't know what the this feature is they were talking about. Are they saying this feature meaning the whole game? Or anyway, I just backed out of that and, you know, said, yes, I understand, you know, I can't play, use this feature or whatever, you know. But it did let me continue on into the game. And so every time I fire up the game from a turned off system, I do see that dumb notification and I just skip past it or whatever. And I've still been able to play the game. So you don't need a PlayStation Plus subscription. And you, as far as I can tell, you may not even need to be connected online to play this game, apart from maybe the initial kind of booting it up, you know, when you first get the game. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, you do still in kind of a pseudo, it has some pseudo MMO type qualities to it, though. Like whenever you're about to go out on a quest, then it's like it creates an instance for you. If you don't know what an instance is, I'm not sure if I'm going to describe it accurately, but it's basically like a just kind of a version of the game world that is boxed off that's for you to go into and maybe some other players that are with you. Whereas like when you're in an open world game and you're in the open world hub, everybody that's on that server, you know, their characters are all over the place. But then when you go into a specific dungeon, the dungeon is an instanced dungeon. You and your friends can enter it together, but 30 seconds later, if someone else enters the dungeon, they're going to enter their own separate copy of that dungeon. So what it seems to be doing when I go on these quests is creating a new instance of that kind of that outdoor area. Because whenever I'm ready to go, it puts me in standby mode and I have to wait like 30 to 60 seconds for it to kind of like tell me, okay, your quest is ready, you can go. And I'm like, oh, this is weird, I don't like this. But at least when you do that, you can go over to the canteen, which is right nearby, get a meal cooked up for yourself to give you some buffs ready for your quest, and you can spend your time doing that a little bit. So, which is a cool thing. That the whole meal system, that's another thing you can do, is you're going out and getting ingredients, and then every time before you go out on a mission, it's highly recommended that you have the chef at the canteen put together, you know, one of a number of different meals that all have different buffs for you and stuff. So there is no end to things you can collect that can be used for specific things. There's ecological data you can collect that will increase your intel on hunts. There are monster parts, of course, you can get to boost to use to build ammo and armor. There are armor spheres that you can earn at the end of like special outings to just upgrade your existing armor without like actually changing it. There are like ingredients for potions, ingredients for meals that you can make. I mean, holy crap. If you like going out and like collecting ingredients, looting things, and using it to build stuff and make yourself more powerful, then this game has that going on in spades. Anyway, back to the solo element of the experience. You know, I see notifications that like so-and-so has entered the online session, so-and-so has left the online session, and you know, that's kind of annoying. I haven't figured out a way to turn those notifications off. I don't think I'm going to be able to. The HUD, the kind of like the information that's on the screen about your health and what buttons do what and stuff, it does tend to be pretty busy, especially when you're out in the wild, you know, on a mission or something like that. So I wish that there was a way to kind of customize that and simplify that a little bit more. But anyway, so there's an awareness now and then of like being in a game that's intended to be multiplayer, but I haven't seen another player. I think that like, even though they're saying, you know, so-and-so has entered the online session, I've only seen NPCs. I've not seen anybody with an obvious, you know, Monkey Dookie 674 username, you know, all the usernames I've seen and the people I've seen running around, even when it's telling me so-and-so and so-and-so and all these people have entered the session, I've still only seen in the hub anywhere just NPCs. So I think apart from those kind of notifications, or maybe like someone sending you a guild card, and you know, which I don't know what those do. This, I don't know. I think apart from some of those elements, if you want to have a solo experience as I do when I play video games, I think this is still totally has a viable solo experience for you. That said, there is one element of the multiplayer MMO-ish nature of the game that makes it what I called in my trial and error review, not family-friendly. And I don't mean that in the typical sense. I mean, I think family-friendly content, as we normally use the phrase, absolutely has its place. For those of you who have been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that especially, you know, years ago, I was very frustrated because there was kind of like a prevailing mentality among Christian content publishers that, you know, if something wasn't like squeaky clean, then you couldn't call it Christian. You know, if anything was dark and edgy or whatever, you know, it has to be family friendly, even if it's only adults that are going to be consuming it, you know. And that, I think that attitude and that expectation has been changing over the years. But anyway, I would still say that family friendly content, as we use the phrase, has its place. Absolutely. We need stuff like that. That's good to have. But I'm using it in a different way. And by that, I mean, you can't pause this game. You can't pause the game. And when you're in the middle of a mission, a timed mission, and you can't pause the game, well, then if someone in your family, I have two boys, one 7 and one 10, and if they want to come in and ask me a question, I want to be able to instantly pause my game and say, hey, what's up, kiddo? You know, instead of like being, no, not now, daddy's, or whatever, you know, I don't want to do that. Or if my wife comes in and she has a question or something she wants to talk about, she's like, hey, where's, you know, about the grocery bill or, you know, some other bookkeeping thing. She does the bookkeeping for us. And so sometimes she'll come in and have questions for me about, did you make a purchase? Here. I just, you know, so I know where to put it in the bookkeeping, that just whatever question, whatever, blah, blah, blah question. Or if it's something that takes a little bit longer, she's like, hey, do you have a few minutes? We got to troubleshoot this thing. We got to schedule, blah, 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 you know, whatever. I want to be able to do that, you know? Don't get me wrong. I mean, those aren't particularly fun. In my flesh, I'm like, you know, leave me alone. I want to play video games, you know? But what I'm saying is, in my new created self that I am endeavoring to embrace more and more, I want to be free and available for those things. And if you can't pause the game, then you basically have two choices. You've got to find a place to hide really quick, which admittedly, it does seem possible. There's little bushes around, and one of the things they show you early on is that when you're standing in some brush and you press X, then you can go into a hidden mode. And I've had at least smaller monsters, I haven't tested this with bigger ones, at least smaller monsters actually rub up against me and even bump me around as they're walking through that bush. And as long as I'm crouched, then they stop attacking me. They even will see me go into the bush, and then I'll press duck, and then they'll walk around in the bush, bumping me around. It's like I'm not, you know, they're totally unaware of me, even though they're running right into me. So I think that's a possibility, but there's not always those things that are immediately handy, especially if you're in the thick of a boss fight, you know, then those big suckers can traverse a lot of ground really fast. It gets pretty hairy. And then some bosses, I haven't run into any of this type yet, but some bosses later on, they'll regenerate. If you leave them alone long enough, they'll regenerate, you know? So, excuse me. Wow. I just let a burp out there right in the middle of my, so you've either got to, hide and let them potentially go regenerate or for your time to run out, or just like put down the controller and just let yourself get totally slaughtered, in which case you're going to have to start the whole boss fight over again. So I've been enjoying my time with this game. Let me come back to that a little bit. I'm all scattered. I didn't organize my thoughts before doing this, so I apologize. I think I'm wrapping it up here. The combat controls. Let me circle back, because I'm gonna wrap up by saying, you know, spoiler, that I'm enjoying this game, but so I'll get to that in a second. The combat controls are kind of clunky. I'm actually using the what's supposed to be among the easiest weapon sets that you can use. Right at the start of the game, you have access to 14 different weapon types. And then as the game progresses, you just make each of those versions of those weapon sets more powerful. You upgrade them with new materials instead of blah, 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 blah. And I don't know if they gain different move sets as you do that or not, but they each have their own move sets. So if you imagine kind of like in my trial and error review, I kind of compared it to a Street Fighter, like a, you know, 1v1, you know, fighting game where you have these combos that you have to memorize and stuff. It's actually not as complicated as that. That was just kind of me being flustered and saying, geez, this is like a frigging fighting game, you know. It's not that complex at all. In fact, like most of the combos are just hitting a single button over and over again that I've seen so far using the sword and shield. The other ones, I did pick up another one of the weapons and they are more complex, and there's, you know, but every weapon you pick up, it's going to be a different combo. It's going to have different buttons that do different things, depending on whether it's ranged or melee or whatever. So it's almost like learning each weapon set is like learning a different game's combat, you know, buttons and combat button layout and combat combos. So, I mean, there's, in a sense, there's kind of like 14 games worth of fighting systems built into this game. So, but even so, I am getting the hang of it. The button layouts are a little bit unconventional. I'm used to using square to attack in most of these third-person types of games, if it's a melee attack. This one, it's triangle, it's that top button, and then circle, the outside button on the right. That I'm using to attack with, which, you know, that's all right. That's all right. I think Dragon Quest Builders had me using triangle to attack, maybe. So anyway, I'm adapting to that, and I'm even thinking, you know, I can imagine down the road somewhere being comfortable enough that I'll be like, you know, I want to learn a different weapon, you know, because they each have their strengths and weaknesses, you know, and if you take on something that has a more difficult control scheme, then there are benefits that can really pay off if it also fits with your personal, play style. You know, if you like to be, like, get in there and just go nuts, then there's a weapon for that. If you like to really stay at a distance and do more kind of like sniping or distance attacking, there's a weapon for that. If you're really good at like watching animation timings and like timing your attack just the right way and stuff, if you're that kind of gamer, then you can really have a weapon that will really pay off that kind of skill, you know. But from what I understand, you know, you can go with the sword and shield option and basically just hack and slash your way, or buttons mash, I should say, through most of the game and, you know, figure out how to make it work, and that's really been working for me so far. You know, you just make sure you're stocked up on all the potions you need, and I'm a little disappointed with how the hotkeys work. That's not super intuitive. I go into that a little bit in the video, which you can look at if you want, but they're not as easily and quickly accessible as hotkeys compared to maybe, you know, some other games, or, you know, but and it's not been that big of a deal. Again, if you watch the video, you're gonna see me getting the crap knocked out of me, beaten, knocked around, and really doing badly, playing badly, controlling the character badly, and yet still beating these missions and beating them in a decent amount of time, like between 7 and 15 minutes, you know, these hunts. So even, you know, if you feel like you're getting knocked around and stuff like that, at least in my case, I felt like I'm still somehow doing this. I think what adds to that kind of disbelief and like, wow, I'm really doing well, is the fact that there are no health bars on the enemies or their body parts or whatever. They have added damage numbers to your weapons. In previous Monster Hunter games, as I understand it, when you would attack a monster, it wouldn't even show a damage number to show like how much damage you're doing to it. And so you just had to keep hammering at these monsters and watching their behavior to see if they were limping or getting tired or anything like that to get a sense of how well you're doing in the fight. And I think the argument there was from realism, blah, blah, blah. But as I kind of mentioned in my video, you know, realism, it's really, we all kind of want realism just selectively. We want some things to be more realistic and other things to be less realistic. So it all depends on your preferences, you know. Personally, I still would like a health meter in this game because there's some bosses that as I was fighting them, and you can see in the video, I was like, this is taking a longer than the last one. This is getting annoying. I can't tell if I'm making any progress with this guy, you know. But it's not that it went super long. I wasn't getting feedback. I didn't know how I was doing, you know? And so since they can't like, you know, I guess it's probably asking too much of video game technology to have them record every slash and strike as a wound on the body of the monster that I'm fighting so I can visually see how many times I've hit him and whether or not he's bleeding and stuff. Yeah, I recognize that's a lot of data to keep track of and kind of add to the game. It would be really cool. I would love that. I'd take that over a health bar. But since we can't get that, I would like to have a health bar because that realistically simulates what my character would be seeing in damage on the monster because my character is there. They would be aware of how much damage the monster's taking, you know. So anyway, there are a few, you know, things that I'm like, ah, you know. But on the whole, I'm really enjoying it. There are some really cool moments in combat. The music might become repetitive because they seem to be using the same kind of track every time I fight a monster. But it's this cool orchestral, you know, almost like I want to say Jurassic Park-y, you know, suspense music. And, you know, just these monster fights are intense, you know. I mean, you really have to stay on top of your health potions and you really, you know, you have to dodge and stuff like that. And again, you know, don't worry if you suck like I do because I was getting knocked around a lot and I died once. If you die, you just kind of get warped back to your camp and you can still just rush right out, find that monster again and he'll still be pretty much wounded the way you left him and you can pick it up from there. You have 3 lives. You can, you know, once you die the third time, I think, then the mission is canceled out. But I think you can die twice without penalty. And the monster fights, they feel just like really cool, epic, and intense. You can find yourself jumping on top of their back and like stabbing them over and over again, and then you have to brace to hang on while they're trying to shake you off. It's just like, it's thrilling. It's thrilling. And the world is really cool to explore. It's beautiful, and all the different things you can pick up, and the sound design is great too. I love the crunchy boots. I love all the different monster sounds, and it's cool to see the ecology of this world. You know, you'll be fighting one monster and suddenly another monster from out of nowhere will jump into the fray and he might pick a side. He might fight with you or he might fight against you or just as you're off in the distance, you might see a big monster come out and start feeding on like some grazing monsters and then a bigger monster or a monster that's about the same size will come out and the two monsters will start fighting and one will die and the other will leave and you can go and pick up the leftover dead body parts of the monster that was defeated and use that to craft stuff for yourself, you know. So it's cool just feeling like this, you know, being a part of this living kind of breathing world and just kind of figuring out how you want to navigate it, how you want to use the environment to your advantage and play to your strengths and not your weaknesses. And anyway, so I've really been enjoying myself and I see great potential for me to really sink my teeth into this and get to know all the systems, kind of like getting to know a paper and pencil RPG front to back and the world just comes alive as you do that, you know. But it's going to take an investment of time. It's going to take probably some looking frequently on the internet to learn some things. That's a little bit of a bummer. I wish there was a big glossary in the game that I could look things up. I think it's just going to be one of those games like, okay, they're kind of just leaning on the community to really provide stuff for you to, you know, to learn. The good news is there is such a huge rabid fan base. It's a cult fan base, but a huge rabid fan base for these games. There's already a ton of great content out there for Monster Hunter World that I think could help you with any question that you might have about the game. So anyway, I think I'm comfortable at this point with just kind of realizing, okay, I'm going to have to do that. My PC is right next to my computer. It's a little bit of a pain to put down the controller, slide over to my PC, open up my browser, and do a little Google search, but it's not that big of a deal. The bigger deal, I would say, is not being able to pause. That it's not a deal breaker, but it's a problem. It means that, you know, for a game that to get the most out of it, you could end up putting up to 300 hours or more into it. I mean, there's a lot of potential, and man, I love the sound of that. I'm like, I love games that can give you that much playtime for your money. Oh, man. But I'm going to be really limited in when I can play this game. I can't just pop it in, you know, any old Saturday afternoon while the family's just kind of bumming around the house, you know? Or at least if I'm going to, I need to communicate with my family and I need to, you know, say, hey, is now an okay time for the next, you know, 20 minutes or so maybe for me to go take on a hunt, you know? And then, you know, have to go make the rounds with my wife and my two boys, you know, every time I'm about to take on one of those missions. I don't know. I mean, I think they'd actually be very gracious, especially, you know, my boys would probably not care at all. And you know, my wife, I think, would be very gracious and, just understanding if she was, you know, if I was in the middle of a boss fight. Sometimes I'll even come in and, you know, there are some games that I play that have cutscenes you can't pause, which is a really big pet peeve of mine. But she's been gracious and understanding. When she comes in and sees that a cutscene's running, she knows that I'll pause it if I can. And if not, she'll either just wait for a minute or she'll just say, I'll come back in a minute, you know. I think what I just have to remember and what I would put out there on the table to anybody that's considering this game, if you have a family or, you know, any relationships, people that you're living with, remember the people in your life, you know, and remember the potential impact that playing this game could have on that. What I don't want to do, I already know my flesh. I know just kind of the sickness that still remains in me that has yet to be stripped away by Christ. That could easily resent my family for interrupting my precious video game time, you know. I know that that's in me, even with a game that I can pause immediately, you know. I know that that tendency is there. I really have to fight against that. So I can only imagine how much worse it would be in a game where I can't pause. Okay, that was crazy. Just after I said that, my wife appeared in the window to my office, reminding me that I had to go pick up our boys, which I'd forgotten about because I got lost in recording this podcast. But thankfully, I could pause my recording and go pick them up. So now I'm back now. Let me try to regather my train of thought now. It really is going to limit the times that I can play the game, but I'm enjoying it when I play it. I will say, I forgot to mention this before, the upgrade cycle, the looting and upgrading cycle has been pretty steady so far with my armor. And with a little bit of crafting stuff, I've started crafting a few potions here and there, but not much. And most of it is auto-crafting. There's a cool auto-crafting setting that they don't tell you about. So I didn't know that I was like automatically crafting potions as I pick up ingredients for them. It's a cool feature. I just wish I would have known, why are my ingredients disappearing? Oh, I have potions I didn't have before, you know. But the weapon upgrades I haven't upgraded my weapon once yet. Armor I've been upgrading pretty steadily, but not my weapon I haven't upgraded once yet. And that upgrade system is a little more obscured to me. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but so far I haven't needed it yet. But I will look forward to it, because the one thing that I will say about the combat that was kind of like getting on my nerves a bit, that I'm hoping will be greatly minimized as I learn to upgrade my weapon, is sharpening your weapon. You know, you've got health, of course, you have stamina, which they don't tell you very much about, but you get a sense pretty quickly of how it affects you and, you know, how it limits you. But you also have sharpness of your blade. As you use your weapon, it becomes more and more dull, and when it loses its sharpness, its damage goes way, way down. And so you can find yourself in the middle of these longer battles, you know, just like a 10-minute battle, having to stop and sharpen your weapon like 3 or 4 times. Ridiculous. So that was really kind of just an annoyance. But again, even with that, I've been having a lot of fun. Those are epic, fun, thrilling monster battles. I really enjoy exploring the world. I really enjoy getting into this game more. I'm just going to be limited in terms of when I can give time to it. Okay, those are all of my thoughts for now. If you want, you can check out the video, which is titled Solo Monster Hunter Isn't Family Friendly, over at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, and you can watch me as I'm figuring things out and getting my butt kicked and still somehow managing to get through it all. I had a lot of fun with this playthrough because the character generation system had a model. I went with a female protagonist, and they had a face model that, like, all I had to do was basically change the hair color, and it looks quite a bit like my wife. And so I named my hero Holly, and then by chance, there's like a little cat friend that follows you around and acts as your you always have one at least default NPC that's helping you out, and it's this little cat that goes that you can put armor on, and you can choose what color their fur is, and you can name them. And I hate cats, but my wife really likes them, and she has a dear departed cat from childhood that I named this cat after. So anyway, if you want, you can check that out and see me having a little bit of fun with that. So, all right, those are my thoughts for now. I hope that's helpful to you if you were considering checking out Monster Hunter World. I want to remind you guys to check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POSTOS, Helix Reviews, and the Retro Rewind podcast. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Okay, kiddo, pop quiz time. Best movie franchise?
The Terminator.
Not even close. The Matrix. Best TV show?
Star Trek.
What? Farscape. You have to know that it's Farscape. It's like you're not even my son. Unless you're not my son.
I don't like your voice. It irritates me.
Hey, wait.
Let's make another call.
No, please.
And another, and another, and another. You are very messy. Okay, bye-bye.
Winchester. The synopsis on IMDb reads, inspired by true events. On an isolated stretch of land 50 miles outside of San Francisco sits the most haunted house in the world. Built by Sarah Winchester, Academy Award winner Helen Mirren, heiress to the Winchester fortune, it is a house that knows no end. Constructed in an incessant 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week mania for decades, it stands 7 stories tall and contains hundreds of rooms. To the outsider, it looks like a monstrous monument to a disturbed woman's madness. But Sarah is not building for herself, for her niece, played by Sarah Snook, or for the brilliant Dr. Eric Price, played by Jason Clarke, whom she has summoned to the house. She is building a prison, an asylum for hundreds of vengeful ghosts, and the most terrifying among them have a score to settle with the Winchesters. I've got a little bit more depth in my voice. I've been fighting a cold this week, so I'm trying to capitalize on that a little bit. All right, so let me talk about... This is probably going to be a little bit of a shorter review than usual. I didn't like this movie. Let me talk about the story and the script a little bit. It's a familiar ghost story formula with, you know, a spooky house, at least one kind of true believer, that's the Widow Winchester, who believes in all the ghosts and stuff, who is in touch with the spirit world. And then you've got a skeptic, in this case, the doctor hired to evaluate the widow's mental health to see if she's still fit to run half of the Winchester Rifle Company. And it's a period piece, which is one thing that I'll give it. I was like, okay, that does make it a little bit different to have it be a period piece. I think the last time I saw a ghost story that was the period piece was The Others. Is that the Nicole Kidman movie? I think that was a period piece. I'm not sure. Anyway, so, I mean, it had that going for it. But anyway, this doctor, it's in the early, like, 1909 is when the movie takes place. And the doctor comes to investigate, and eventually, you know, he believes. That's kind of the formula of the skeptic in these things. They believe or they get killed, you know, right before they believe or whatever, or right, you know, after they believe. But unlike many ghost movies, and perhaps because this one is based on true events, I should say actually inspired by, which means, you know, who knows how loosey-goosey they're playing with history. But perhaps because it's kind of grounded or inspired by true events, no one's getting killed by these ghosts. That was a big problem for me. The ghosts are mostly just moving things around and appearing in reflections of mirrors and all the usual misdirection jump scare stuff that we've seen a bunch of times before in ghost movies. I did not find this movie scary at all. It got a couple flinches out of me, but no, like, jumps, you know? No edge-of-my-seat suspense. I mean, it was like nothing for the entire experience. I think this was largely due to the lack of threat the ghosts presented to me for most of the movie. I just kind of felt like they were going to just kind of keep messing with people and maybe scaring some people, but I didn't, you know, I feel like even though it's formulaic, it's helpful to have someone get killed horribly, dying, screaming early on so that we are wondering who's going to go next, who is going to suffer the fate that person suffered at the beginning. But they didn't have that kind of grab you at the beginning moment to show you how scary the ghosts were. They just kind of eased you slowly into, are there ghosts here? Are there not? Okay, pretty early on you realize, yeah, this is legit. This is really happening, you know. I think there's some things they could have done to make it more of a question, because the doctor was abusing some medication, kind of keeping it quiet, but it would cause him to hallucinate a little bit. I think if they would have maybe shot the movie a little bit differently, maybe, or done post-production a little bit differently, that maybe they could have made me wonder for a little bit, are these just illusions or whatever, you know? But now they give away pretty early on, no, these ghosts are legit, you know? So anyway, so largely due to the lack of threat that the ghost presented for most of the movie, and what seemed to me to be kind of like the lack of cinematic originality in what the ghosts did, you know, how they messed with people, lots of beats we've seen before, you know, just little things rolling past and little things bumping or whatever, you know. The script also felt long and full of repetitious story beats, especially when it came to people slowly walking around in the dark and turning around quickly as objects move, or they almost see something that maybe the audience sees, but they don't, you know. There was a lot of that without it really paying off and going anywhere until like the very, very end. I likely would have been much more interested in either a real documentary about the real history of the house and the widow. I think that would be kind of interesting to check out maybe. Or barring that, I think this could have made a good, for me at least, 45-minute episode of a supernatural anthology TV show. So anyway, the cast was all fine. I do kind of wonder if I might have liked someone else better as the widow, someone more strange and creepy than Helen Mirren. You know, maybe an unknown in that role that was just kind of like more of a character actor would have been an interesting choice. I don't know. As far as visuals, there are a few visual effects, but most things are being done practically, which I appreciate. Although, you know, that said, they're not doing a whole lot, you know, visually, either practically or with special effects. You know, there just wasn't a lot of like interesting visual ghosty stuff going on in this movie. The house was also an interesting construct to look at, and it made me wonder. I was either like, dang, did they like build a replica of this whole house? I mean, it was kind of neat to look at. Or I even wondered, could they be filming this like on the actual location? I kind of doubt that, but you know, it was interesting to look at. Made me kind of wonder some of those things. But the most striking visual feature to me, which I didn't think helped my experience, was the color palette. There was something about it that felt too kind of warm and mundane for the mood of a ghost story. Maybe I'm just used to creepy, washed out, cooler colors, you know, when it comes to these kinds of stories, but something felt, I don't know, kind of warm and sunny and welcoming about the environments a lot of the time. Anyway, so I always try to ask myself, you know, when I'm watching a movie like this, is there anything of worthwhile moral, philosophical, or spiritual significance going on that might stimulate worthwhile thought or conversation? For me, I don't think so, unless you're specifically looking for something like I tend to do as I watch stuff like this. Like a number of ghost stories, God is left out of the equation in this movie. The afterlife is about a person being at peace with themselves and being at peace with the life that they lived and the choices they made. They don't come out and use the phrase forgive yourself, but that does seem to be kind of a key component to having peace in the afterlife, which that doesn't make any sense to me. The whole idea of forgiving yourself just logically doesn't make sense. So it's not about facing, the afterlife in this movie is not about facing any kind of accountability. There aren't like really good spirits and really evil spirits. It's more about spirits that are angry or restless versus those who stick around, you know, and cause trouble versus those who are at peace with themselves and go away to who knows where. So in this kind of worldview, the individual is the highest authority in the afterlife. Likewise, those who successfully combat angry spirits, you know, who are still alive combating angry spirits, the most successful ones are those who draw on themselves, their own courage. Those who understand the most about the spiritual world are those who pay attention to their feelings and their intuition. So it really kind of all this together boils down to the popular spiritual thinking of today, which essentially is follow what you feel, you command your destiny, and you're the only one in charge of you. The problem with thinking there is any hope to be found in this worldview is that it doesn't hold up under examination. If I'm in charge of me in the afterlife, there's no reason to think that my character will become more virtuous or be improved at all by the process of dying. Why would that happen? Unless something else is affecting me. But if I'm in charge of me, if I have nothing else is in you know, exerting any change or will upon me and my character, then why would I change just from the act of leaving this body and, you know, going into the afterlife or whatever? And so, since I don't think there's any reason to think that that would happen, that means that I will still forever and eternally annoy, neglect, or hurt people like I do in this life right now. And if eternity is filled with people like that, then why should we think there's any possible peace after this life? The reality is that we need something or someone that is external to ourselves to change us and reshape our character. We have to willingly allow someone who is capable to do that to us so that we will be compatible contributors to an eternally living community that will remain at peace. Without something or someone to change us, we have no reason to think the next life will be any better than this one. In fact, a life just like this one that instead lasts forever, for a lot of people, that sounds a bit like hell. Anyway, I have no idea what your preferences are in movies, but if I were a time traveler, I would go back in time and say, Vader, skip this one. Maybe just do a Google search on the Winchester Mansion if you want a little bit of trivia. That might be interesting to read. This movie is going to have you bored out of your gourd. It's rated PG-13 for violence, disturbing images, drug content, some sexual material, and thematic elements.
Data collection complete. Activating MusaNet 1.0.
Okay, I don't normally plug other websites in this segment, but longtime member of the Christian Geek Central community, John Wilkerson, has posted a review with his daughter for the latest Maze Runner movie. So if you were disappointed that I suddenly changed my plans last week and ended up not reviewing that movie as I had intended to, then you can check out their interaction over the movie over at strugglingforpurpose.com. Strugglingforpurpose.com, and once you're there, just in the search field, put in Maze Runner Death Cure. Again, at strugglingforpurpose.com. Let's see here. At youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, I've posted Heart and Mind in Worship. That's the video version of our In Search of Truth study for Ephesians chapter 5, verses 18 through 21. I also posted Welcome to the World of Christian Fantasy, which was the speculative faith article I shared on the podcast recently. It's the video version of that. And then, of course, my solo Monster Hunter World Isn't Family Friendly trial and error video, which runs about like over 40 minutes, but I experimented with timestamps this time. So if you want, you can go over and just see, you know, you can just click and jump straight to my monster hunts and not see me fumbling through menus and trying to figure out the mechanics of the game. You can just skip to the parts that you're interested in. So anyway, again, that's called Solo Monster Hunter World Isn't Quote Unquote Family Friendly. And then also, hopefully by now, you should be able to find my Winchester, The House That Ghosts Built Uncut review. Again, all of that at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. And while you're there, if you want to like, share, or subscribe, that is a good way to help grow that channel and the Christian Geek Central community. On the Christian Geek Central Facebook and Twitter pages is the question of the week, which is simply Farscape or Babylon 5. This is a recently revived old topic from our forums that's generated some new discussion. You guys know I'm going to vote Farscape, but I'm increasingly interested in giving Babylon 5 another try, and I've appreciated kind of hearing some of the merits of Babylon 5, and it's kind of renewed my interest in it again. So, but I'd love to hear what your pick is between Farscape or Babylon 5. You can leave your 2 cents on Facebook and Twitter, or follow the link from there to our forums and join the conversation. All right, what else we got? Just a reminder, guys, if you want to help make sure Spirit Blade Productions can keep doing what we're doing or do more of it, both faster and better, you're invited to make a donation of any amount, anytime, or become a part of the Spirit Blade Insider Program and get monthly exclusive goodies. I'm going to be announcing something in the coming weeks, going to be later in February, about something I'm really excited to share with you guys. Insiders at this point are already hearing some things about that. I'm going to actually be sending a sample of what I'm working on to them very soon. So anyway, if you are interested in kind of getting the behind the scenes view of all the inner workings of Spirit Blade Productions and Christian Geek Central, then you can check out those. You can be a Spirit Blade Insider, and you get these monthly audio journal entries that I record throughout the month about the ups and downs, the wild roller coaster ride, sometimes the frustrations and the excitement of trying to spin all these plates as one guy in his office at home. So anyway, you can get a driver's, well, not a driver's seat. What do you call that? A passenger front row, front pass. I don't know. You get a really good view of what's going on. Anyway, you can get more information on our About page over at spiritblade.com. And while you're there, of course, you're also invited to support us by purchasing a download of one of our original sci-fi or fantasy audio dramas for a friend or family member using our available gift codes. Again, for information, visit spiritblade.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
Well, right now, I'm going to attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language that we can often take for granted, digging into history and languages when I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply at least some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in Scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth, and that's something that we can all do, so I hope you'll do that with me. This time, we're looking at the book of Ephesians, as we have been for a while now, and we've arrived at chapter 5, verses 21 through 27. In the ESV, that reads, "Submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives, as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish." All right, as we saw last time, there is some question among Bible scholars about whether or not verse 21 is meant to be the end of the previous paragraph or the first sentence in the paragraph about marriage. The Expositor's Bible Commentary from Zondervan Publishing explains, "While grammatically it may be attached to verse 20, its content coincides more naturally with what follows. Last time we applied verse 21, assuming a connection to the previous verses, and this time we'll look at it again in connection with the verses that follow about marriage." So, looking at verse 21 now, in the ESV again, it says, "Submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ." Whether intended for this context or the preceding one, husbands and wives, as fellow believers in Christ, should be constantly aiming to submit to each other, motivated by the desire to respect and honor Jesus. Husbands and wives have different roles in the marriage relationship, but both should be aiming to submit to the other. verses 21 through 24 now again says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands." All right. These verses are not popular or easy to hear, especially because of how they have been abused over the years. But we still need to hear, understand, and obey them. Wives are meant to submit to their husbands as they would to Jesus if he were standing right in front of them. In the organizational structure of marriage, the husband is the head in the same way that Christ leads the church. Paul doesn't say why this is the case. We shouldn't infer from this that men are in any way superior or more qualified to lead than women. This is just the way God has designed marriage to be, for reasons we may not understand in this life. This means that wives should not be trying to manipulate or parent their husbands. Instead, they should aim to plead and respectfully persuade their husbands when they are in disagreement. This is a super challenging task because, speaking from experience, wives often have better ideas than their husbands, or they may keep track of important details that husbands miss. That's certainly true in our house. So it may be a natural urge for many wives to kind of want to fix their husbands. But giving into that urge will likely damage the relationship in small but festering ways. Speaking again from personal experience, I suspect most husbands will be inclined to favor the ideas and suggestions of wives who present their thoughts as gentle requests rather than expectations. Verses 25 through 27 now says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish." Despite the abuses of verses 22 through 24, these verses now begin a section of instruction for husbands that is actually much longer than the section for wives. In fact, the first hint of instruction for husbands, I think, started back in verse 23, when the wife is compared to the body of Christ and the husband is compared to Christ as the Savior of his body, the church. That image is taken further in these verses. Husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church. The word for love is, again, the familiar agape love that we've talked about before, which selflessly prioritizes another over oneself. Husbands are to love their wives in this way to the same degree that Christ loved the church, giving up his life for her. While only a rare few husbands will ever be in a situation requiring their death in exchange for the life of their wife, it's vital to remember as we look at this idea of giving up our lives, men, for our wives, it's vital to remember that Christ didn't just die for the church. He daily lived a hard, sacrificial life in order to rescue the church. So this giving up of himself that Christ did, this was a lifelong thing. He daily lived this sacrificial life to rescue the church. It was the way that he lived that made his sacrifice worthy and capable of redeeming us from sin. He lived every moment as an exemplary sacrifice to God, both securing our rescue and demonstrating how we should live. It's that kind of commitment that husbands are meant to pursue, a daily death to our own desires in service to our wives. I think there are also some parallels between how Christ sees the church and how husbands should see their wives. These verses reveal that Christ gave himself for all believers so that they might be set apart and made ready. That's the meaning of sanctify, for his eternal purposes. Believers are ushered into the sanctified community of believers through baptism, we see in verse 26, with the ultimate aim of being presented to Christ together in a completely flawless state, which is described in verse 27. Now, I don't think this is just a little rabbit trail of theology Paul is going off on. There is likely a parallel here we're meant to see. Christ loves us so deeply and wants us to be as beautiful and spotless as he intended us to be at our creation. So his life was dedicated to that purpose. In a similar way, I think it should be the aim of husbands, as the head of the marriage, to want to safeguard and rescue their wives, desiring for their beauty and dignity to shine and their sin to be left behind. This being the case, the husband is also meant to be the spiritual head of the home. Now, before that has a chance to sound like husbands passing moral judgment on their wives at the dinner table or something, we have to look again at how Christ serves as head of the church, and how he served in his life as well. Well, specifically in his life here, in order to sanctify us, he didn't bring shame, but love and self-sacrifice. He exemplified the character he wants us to have. Now, yes, there will be many times where both husbands and wives will need to bring sin to the other's attention. But Jesus showed that leading is most effectively done when accompanied by service and example. The wording is important here as well, I think. These instructions are about voluntary doing on the part of husbands and wives, not enforcing to each other. These are not commands for husbands to dominate wives or for wives to feel entitled to their husband's constant adoration. These are not verses to be angrily quoted as weapons in the midst of marital conflict. The temptation will be to only obey these commands to the degree we think our spouse is holding up their end of the bargain, quote unquote. But the intention here is that marriage be approached this way by each spouse voluntarily and unconditionally. At the same time, these verses also do not advocate staying under the same roof with a spouse that is physically or emotionally abusive. Remember that our submission in marriage is out of reverence for Christ. I believe that in the case of abuse in marriage, it is most honoring to Christ to seek help and healing for that marriage, which may involve separating while that recovery is pursued. If you believe you may be experiencing emotional or physical abuse from a spouse, I want to urge you to tell someone about it. Just wrapping up here, my wife and I do not have a perfect marriage. We fail each other regularly and have to have some hard talks now and then. And as I've looked at these verses this week, just preparing this study, and thought about how I've performed as a husband, I have felt the sobering grip of conviction, looking at this and saying, wow, crap, that's the kind of love that I need to be pursuing, and I'm nowhere close to that. But I can also remember how beautiful marriage has been when my wife and I have found a measure of success in pursuing these things. It's bound to be bumpy and messy, but marriage is an amazing covenant relationship that gives life and blessing to the degree we pursue it as God intends. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we can, but I've got to hear from you to do that. You can send an email or audio file recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. And once again, guys, if you would like some help finding a good church in your area, I want to help you if I can. Online resources and communities are a good supplement, but by nature, they can't speak to your particular situation like relationships in a local church can. The context for almost everything in the New Testament assumes that we are serving and building purposeful relationships in a local church. So whether you're in a church that lacks Bible-based intentionality or not attending any church at all, if I can help you get connected to an authentic, Bible-oriented church, I want to do that. Email me at paeter@spiritblade.com, and we can try to look at some websites of churches in your area together. All right, that's it, guys. Stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, I will share a review of the movie Beyond Skyline, which not a lot of people I've heard talk about the original Skyline. It was not a... It definitely got a pretty wide theatrical release. It was directed by, I think, a pair of brothers. brothers or something, or two guys that were known for their special effects work, and this was their first movie that they directed. And as a result, you know, it was, you know, maybe not the best movie in the world, but the visual effects for the budget they had were really, really good. And I actually enjoyed it quite a bit as a monster movie, you know, the type that I talked about earlier, where you're having a monster slowly be revealed over the course of a story, you know. So for that reason, I really enjoyed Skyline. I'm probably going to put it in and watch it again before I check out Beyond Skyline, which is in Redbox now. I just haven't quite gotten around to it yet, but I'm really looking forward to checking that out and sharing my thoughts on it with you next week. And then also, I'm going to do another sweep of the internet with the Christian Geek Radar and share what I find with you guys as well. And don't forget my Games I'm in Love With live stream. This is from 3 to 9 p.m. Pacific next Friday, February 9th. Next Friday, February 9th. This is basically the only time I'm going to talk about it. By the time I talk about it next week, the time probably will have passed for you to take advantage of watching it. So next Friday, February 9th, from 3 to 9 p.m. Pacific at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. I'm going to do a six-hour video game live stream, and those have become a really fun time to just hang out with you guys and chat about, you know, whatever's on your mind, and just kind of like make a fool of myself as I play games terribly and just kind of hang out. So I'd love to do that with you guys. You can come by again next Friday, 3 to 9 p.m. Pacific, youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. Anyway, till then, please consider supporting the work of Christian Geek Central and Spirit Blade Productions by purchasing an audio drama, leaving a donation, or becoming a Spirit Blade Insider. You can get more information from our About page at spiritblade.com. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampton with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Coming through the wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
And we just finished the quickening, and it was an emotional one.
Yeah, it choked us both up a little bit.
Go ahead, Kim.
This is an excellent story. And what's more, it works completely as a standalone story.
But it also fits very well into the Dominion arc.
If you want to try an episode of later good Deep Space Nine without needing to know anything, you can jump right in on this episode and follow it.
You could figure out everything you need to know about who the bad guys are.
Yep.
They don't even show up, but their work is prevalent.
Yes.
Bashir and Dax, they go to this planet because they get called by a distress signal. Turns out it was a 200-year-old Ottoman distress signal, because this is a planet that's been completely destroyed by a plague deliberately introduced by the Dominion. And this plague, you're born with this plague and you will die of this plague, but when it hits is random. And I'm not going to ruin it because there's some gut-churning extra things about this plague.
Yes.
That's even worse.
It's essentially everybody walks around with stage one, and you never know when stage two is going to kick up.
Yeah.
But it will kick up, and it's always fatal.
And painful and miserable.
Yes.
And they encounter someone who's dying of this, and at her request they take her to the nearby hospital. Only to find out hospital is their term for the euthanasia clinic. And, you know, I guess when I first saw this, I thought this is going to be a Dr. Kevorkian kind of thing and all political. But it's not about that. This is about hope. And this is a society that has no hope. And in a society with no hope, a quick, painless end is your hope. And the lady who makes friends with Dr. Bashir and is his best friend and his best help on this planet, she talks about how when she was a kid, she was disappointed that she hadn't quickened as a kid. Because their whole society is built around the idea that you'll get a good death.
It's very Egyptian. Everything is around death.
Yes, but it's not even Egyptian in its glory. It's just, it's the worst. It's, you know, it really is. This is, and also, this is a hint about the Dominion. This is what Earth could become. Because the guy even says, 200 years before, they were just like the Federation. They had the same kind of technology, they had the same optimism. And
for the Dominion, it wasn't enough to kill them, they had to break them.
Yeah, and to make them a lasting example, what happens when you defy the Dominion? In case people start to wonder why, when they're fighting this long, horrible war, just why it's worth doing. So that these bastards can finally be stopped. Because, I mean, this is like a horrifically, genetically powerful and well-made virus. And genetic power is what the Founders do best. They create whole beings, they've made themselves into shapeshifters. So this has the Founders' fingerprints all over it.
And I remember you saying, you very much liking this angle of the story, and I did too, that as soon as they land on this planet and they see that there's this horrible plague, Bashir jumps straight to, how can we help? None of this prime directive crap.
None of this, maybe they're fated to die, so we should just leave them to it.
No, people are suffering, let's fix this.
Yes. And like I say, I don't want to tell you too much of what happens because you got to get carried along. It's extremely emotional. Kim and I were both crying. I was sobbing even more. Peter, I think you would really like this just for that. It is extremely well acted.
Yes.
There was
no actor in this that I was rolling my eyes at.
Yeah. They're all great. And the thing is, there really is no villain except for the unseen Founders who caused this. Like I say, we don't see them, but even the person who's the antagonist of the story.
Yeah, even Mr. Euthanasia.
Yeah, he's like,
sympathetic.
You completely understand why. Again, 200 years. So from 1815 until now, all of life, all over this planet, has been all about trying to die as quickly and easily as you can. And you, it's a wonder that they don't have people just like cutting their own throats all the time. Because, again, it's a terribly painful, you know, like, it takes one person who gets this blight and it quickens. That's why the name is called the quickening. It's quickening as it reaches the final stage.
That stage two where they're going to die within days.
And, well, no, weeks. It took her at least 2 weeks. And that was after she'd been sick for a long time. And it's a lot of great resolve. There's one character who's just, she really is an amazing person. She's a very small, humble person. And you see what an incredible person she is for the sake of her son. And
yeah, she's just, I'm not going to die at least until I can make it to this very important thing.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a roller coaster, up and down, and it all feels very genuine. There's really, I can't think of anything negative to say about this episode. The closest is that it doesn't contribute much to the larger thing.
It's a good character piece for Bashir.
Yeah, and it makes
we
even more sense
really
with the...
drives this person.
And you get a lot more sense, it makes even more sense with the genetic engineering that's going to be happening next season. The exposition that he's already been this, I should say, that you see, you know, he is an amazing doctor. And also a nice detail is they mentioned a long time ago as a comic bit that Bashir actually, he appreciates like simple herbal medicines and tribal cures.
Techniques.
And he eventually will have to use some of them too. And, you know, Dr. Crusher in TNG was like that too, where she knew all those. And it's the same kind of thing. There's more I could talk about this episode, but not much without spoiling things.
Yeah.
And it really is something that you should experience for yourself, because it's an experiential episode.
Definitely see it, but have your Kleenex ready.
Yes. You know, unless you have that heart made of stone or something like that.
Yeah. Unless you may be a robot, it will probably at least get you kind of misty-eyed.
Next, we have a Ferengi comedy episode, but a Ferengi comedy episode I actually like. It's, you know, considered one of the good episodes. So we'll see you next time for Body Parts.